Many of you know that I give a title for a sermon or there's a theme, certainly because today is GLBTQ Pride Sunday. You might think the readings are going to go in a certain way, but I like to throw people off the scent. So the first reading comes from the Gospel of Luke, written at the end of the first century by an anonymous person whom we have known by that name, Lucas, only since the middle of the second century. This story is also found, with some minor variations, in two other Gospels, and is clearly based upon an original story which the writers had before them to shape with their own author's voice. This is Luke's version, and I am leaving one word in the original Greek for a reason.
In the city of Capernaum, a Roman centurion stationed there had a certain doulos, whom he was very fond of. The doulos was very sick, even at death's door. When the centurion heard stories about Jesus, he asked some of the influential locals to speak up on his behalf, so as to ask him to come and heal the doulos. They did so, urging Jesus strongly with these words, "He is very deserving of this boon, for he loves our people, and even contributed to the building of a local meeting house for us." So Jesus went with them toward the house of the centurion. The centurion, however, sent a messenger out to Jesus and said, "Don't trouble yourself to come any further. Stay where you are, for I am not some exemplary person that you should grace my home with your presence. But just give the word from where you are. After all, I understand authority. I tell a private, do this or that, and he does. I tell another to come to me, and he does. If I ask my doulos for a favor, he does it." When Jesus heard this little speech, he was astonished, and he turned to the group of people who were trailing behind him and said, "I have not heard words of such pure confidence anywhere before, even among my own people." And when the messengers went back to the centurion's house, he found his doulos was all better.
The second reading is a very wise observation by a woman named Laura Riding Jackson, from her book called The Telling, written in 1972.
How our story has been divided up among the truth-telling professionals. Religion, philosophy, history, poetry compete with each other for our ears, and science competes with all together. And for each, we have a different set of ears. But though we hear much, what we are told is nothing. None of it gives us ourselves. Rather, each way of telling stories steals us to make its reality of us.
I was walking down the street one day in Boston and saw a colleague, minister of a Unitarian Universalist congregation there. He was walking with someone, happened to be the composer of the piece that was just played by Nathan, Daniel Pinkham. And I said to the minister, I said, "Who's this?" And he said, "Oh, this is Danny Pinkham." And I said, "Oh, Danny Pinkham, we used to sing your Christmas cantata in my church when I was a kid." And he said, "You're surprised I'm still alive, aren't you?" I was. Several times after I first arrived here in Ohio, I had the pleasure of attending a concert of the Bill T. Jones Arne Zane Dance Company. I've been a fan of that company since my California days, never missed a concert out there. Some of you may remember that I have uplifted Bill T. Jones's wisdom found in his performance art, found in his writings and in his talking a number of times in sermons I've given in this pulpit. I even actually ran into Bill while I was interviewing to serve as senior minister of this congregation back in May of 1998. He happened to be walking across the OSU campus just as I happened to be that afternoon, kind of exploring Columbus for the first time. So we stopped and chatted for a while. We're not friends in any meaningful sense of that term. He doesn't really remember my name every time I talk with him. But I have talked with him many times after his performances. And I did write him a long letter once after a concert around Thanksgiving time, thus thanking him personally, not just for the concert, but for a very profound and singular act that happened after the concert, which I received almost as if it had been a personal gift. At the end of each concert at Zellerbach Hall in Berkeley, as the applause was dying down, he and his late beloved, Arne Zane, would turn toward each other and they would kiss. Now, it was a simple act, that kiss. It wasn't a peck on the cheek, mind you, or a bounce off the lips. It was a kiss, a loving kiss. But isn't it funny that even as late as 1986, I had never, ever before seen two men kiss publicly in my whole life? Publicly, I said. Not hidden in the shut-off privacy of a house or some dark bar or restaurant. And to my surprise, I would always get teary when they kissed out there in the open. I waited for that moment at the end of each concert. That compact Italian-Jewish guy, Arne, and that tall African-American guy, Bill. And I told Bill that story in the letter that I wrote. It was sometime after Arne had died, but I met Bill after a concert and told him as he was signing my program how that kiss had strengthened me and encouraged me. And he said, oh, you're the one who wrote that letter. That was a wonderful letter. I've saved it. It was the letter about the kiss. Thank you. Thank you very much. And from that time on, he always remembered not my name, but that I had written a letter about the kiss. Now, of course, people of the same gender have kissed before. That wasn't the first time. They've kissed in public before. I had never seen it. That's all I said. They've kissed in private. And they've kissed over the years. the future King David, according to the scroll of Samuel and the Tanakh, the Hebrew scriptures, went off to a desert place with the crown prince, Jonathan, where, and I'm quoting exactly the English translation, they wept and kissed passionately. The Hebrew can be interpreted no other way. They wept and kissed passionately. But the sad people of this world try to diminish such things, trying to convince me, trying to convince you that David and Jonathan were just friends. As if friendship could be called just anything. It just really irritates me when I hear people saying things like that. And worse, as if friendship always included passionate kissing, which of course makes no sense. It's this kind of denial that has made up much of the story of same gender love and cross-gender identity. And I find myself more and more frustrated and angry that this is so all the way here in the year 2011. It hasn't let up much. The story often told about variant sexuality and gender identity is trotted out at this time of the year because of the Pride Parade. But it's really a very limited little story. The first Pride Parades were held in New York City, Los Angeles, and Chicago on June 28th in 1970. In celebration of the Stonewall riots that had erupted in Greenwich Village the year before. This riot exploded when police raided a working class bar owned by the mafia, as most bars were in New York at that time, but favored by drag queens and homeless street hustlers and other sorts of people on the margins of even Greenwich Village back then. The people in the bar fought back that night, refusing to be arrested for being who they were. And the riots continued for several nights. This is the official capital S story I always hear, and I've told it before. It affirms that all of the sexual and gender identity minority liberation movements began on a day of planned police violence met by relatively unplanned GLBT violence on a late June night of 1969. But the trouble with that story is that it's completely isolated. It doesn't take into consideration any history before it. And worse, it's an entirely urban American story, as if that's where GLBT life takes place only. As if people didn't live out their unique identities and lives long before and openly all over the world. After all, we are in all the world. America is not the world all by itself. And in every era, from ancient times till now, take that story found in the Gospel of Luke. Variant forms of which are found in other Gospels as well, as I told you. No matter what your opinion of Jesus is, no matter whether you think this whole business of him being a healer is just too much for you or not, no one can deny that the Gospels, which give their particular slant on this Galilean story, were indeed set down at the end of the first century and were completed in their final editions very early in the second century. That's an undisputable fact. In other words, 1,000 years before English was born, and smack dab in the middle of a culture very different from our own. So when that story was told, it was told to people with ears that opened only onto that culture and couldn't have imagined us for all the world. Long before any of our words for variant sexuality were used, this story was told. In the first century, the word doulos, like so many English words that I can think of and that you can think of, had many authentic meanings. But one of them meant younger partner in a romantic relationship between two men. Why do we know that first century ears would have heard the word to mean that instead of any of its other five meanings? Because the story is about what? A centurion, a Roman captain in the military in charge of a century, 100 privates, one of whom was his doulos. In training, being mentored to become a centurion one day himself. And this was because the emperor, Augustus, had passed a law forbidding centurions to marry women or have children so they could be moved around the empire easily. But they were allowed a doulos as a sexual partner and a kind of portable family, as well as a mentee to be trained into centurionship. The Greek word used in the story is entimos, meaning much the same meaning as our English cognate, intimate. So the story is the story about a man living openly with his lover in a small lakeside city in the Galilee. Jesus heals the lover of his fever and even praises the centurion for his thoughtfulness in asking him not to come over to his house. He obviously knew that it would taint Jesus' reputation if he was hanging out with one of the oppressors of his own people, and thoughtfully, very thoughtfully, asked him to expel the fever from a distance with his singular authority over evil spirits. Long before Stonewall, someone was living out and in the open, with love, with tenderness, with public kisses, perhaps. The gospel writers don't apologize. They just tell the story. But we don't know that that's the story because a heteronormative, to use a word that you can figure out the meaning of, a heteronormative reading has been given to all ancient texts. No one reads with a gay eye, to quote the television show. In the English Gospels, doulos is rendered as bondservant, and intimations of intimacy are covered over. There are many other stories in the Gospels which speak of same gender issues as well, but all of these have been skillfully disguised and twisted into submission by the heteronormative translators. It's a form of violence to literature, violence to history, and violence to truth. And frankly, it hurts. But even though most of us can't read ancient Greek and that you have to be a scholar to figure these things out, and most of us are not going to do that, all of us in this room can read English. But I would wager cash money that few of us have read about the Iowa Sisterhood, the women living as couples quite openly who serve Unitarian congregations as their ministers in Iowa in the last century. Or few of us have read the story of Deborah Sampson, the Massachusetts woman who dressed herself up as a male and fought in the Revolutionary War, getting wounded several times until she was finally discovered. She was honorably discharged, even though it was illegal for her to be a soldier. She was honorably discharged by George Washington himself, who gave her a pension for her fighting. Some people say that Abraham Lincoln and Joshua Speed, who slept together in the same bed for 4 years, exactly what they say of David and Jonathan. They were just friends. And the fact that they slept in the same bed for 4 years was just the culture of the time. Well, the intimacy of their letters to each other tells another story. Sorry. That story remains entirely hidden, stuffed, denied, and ignored. It infuriates me. But like I already lamented, the story of same-gender love is so parochially American that I need to leave our shores for a few moments to get away from this Stonewall business so as not to think that we invented same-gender love or alternative gender identities, or we are the only ones on earth responsible for courage and freedom. How about vast ancient China and the millions of women who refused to get married but insisted on living with each other, remaining openly coupled? The clumsily cobbled word homosexual was fused from Greek and Latin roots in the 1900s by a Hungarian physician. But the Chinese phrase, translated into English as love of the cut sleeve, means exactly the same thing. And it goes back to 3 centuries before the gospel story was written down on parchment. In Japan, the samurai warriors had wakashu, which translates exactly like the word doulos in Greek for our centurion. Nothing hidden there. In India, the Hijra are referred to as third gender people and have been since long before a European named Ulrich suggested calling gays and lesbians by that same phrase back in 1864. At the famed erotic temple of Khajuraho in India, you can see sculptures of male monks caressing male lay visitors, carved in stone forever, perpetually visible, not hidden. Back in English-speaking lands, Queen Anne and Sarah Churchill had a relationship which some have wanted to shove under the radar, just like that story of David and Jonathan. But again, anyone reading their letters would never be able to do that and still remain that they are honest people. Eleanor Butler and Sarah Ponsby eloped openly in 1778 and settled in Wales. And they were coupled openly for 51 years. The poet William Wordsworth used to visit them at their cottage. No one stoned them for being two women living together, nor were they banned from society. Or what about the tremendous San Francisco-like same-gender love life going on in Berlin before the Second World War? Open, free, totally out in the open until Herr Hitler rose to power. Have you read about the transgender natives in this country, the Bardashis, a word that comes from Arabic, interestingly enough, the Bardashis and the Inamhana, and their importance in Indian culture? Or the same-sex relationships open and out among the Ashanti in Africa, in Ghana, or among the Zande? Or the ritual same-sex behavior among the Ndembu, also in Africa? How about the Mahus in Polynesia, totally out and open, or the Aikane in Hawaii, both terms referring to same-sex relationships which existed without shame or denial? The cultivated stereotype of Islamic culture is that same-sex love is always punished by death. Yet no one killed the still much appreciated authors of the homoerotic and still well-read The Delight of Hearts by Ahmad I. Taipashi, or Omar Khayyam's famous Rubaiyat, or Saadi's Gulistan, all of which celebrate same-gender love undisguised. And my same-gender friends who go dancing right across the street from the royal palace in Saudi Arabia's main city do not live in fear of their lives all day long, nor does the Somali lesbian that I know hide out all day long in Cairo, where she lives openly with her lover, although she's careful, certainly. They know that fanatics exist there, just as they exist here. They are not careless, but they don't define their lives by the possibility of social bullying hiding in every moment. And earlier this year, I twice read readings in services by my Muslim Moroccan gay email bud, Abdel Ataya, who has been featured on the cover of Moroccan magazines, the cover of Moroccan magazines, like their version of Time, as openly gay. He's alive. Now, please don't get me wrong. I understand that bullying and religious and political persecution are real. In several state legislatures recently, the conservative congresses are trying to forbid even mentioning same-sex reality. In North Carolina, where General Assembly is going to happen in a very short time, the legislation is so bad that even some conservative churches are embarrassed by the wording. I know that young folks take their lives each and every day because they are bullied into doing so because of this sexuality business. In this country, in this state, in the year 2011. But I wanted to lift up the story of our story in another way this morning, to remind myself first and foremost that I am a person, not a sexuality, a human being, not a category. When people bully my sexuality, they are bullying me. I cannot separate out parts of myself. I cannot hide sections of my soul just because it upsets somebody's stomach or something. And you can't do that either. Like Laura Jackson says in the second reading, and I'm going to read the whole thing again because it's short, how our story has been divided up among the truth-telling professionals. Religion, philosophy, history, poetry compete with each other for our ears. And science competes with all of them together. And for each, we have a different set of ears. But though we hear much, what we are told is nothing, because none of it gives us ourselves. Rather, each way of telling stories steals us, grabs us, to make its reality of us. None of the story, as we usually tell it, gives me myself. I am more than someone who has been hurt by others. I am someone who has been loved by others and who has loved others much. I am someone who has read the theories of psychologists trying to explain sexual variation and have never found myself there. I have read studies of the brain and find, lo, I am not reducible to a loop in the limbic system. I am a person. I have read the philosopher speaking of constructed same-gender relationships and do not find myself constructed. They are all very passionate, these voices. And like Jackson says, they all want me to buy their own theory, their own lexicon, and to bow to them. Someone wants me to think that I have a lifestyle and not a life. Someone else wants me to admit that I have a weak father and a strong mother. Someone else thinks it's important to look at the length of my middle toe. Someone else wants me to bow to their sociological construction theory, and yet someone else insists that I secretly hate myself and want to be bullied by all this anti-gay legislation. And yet another talking head tells me that it's only my sexual identity which allows me to like things like Bill T. Jones dancing, and that real men, whoever they may be, prefer doing other things. All of this is a complete waste of my time, and it's consummate baloney. So instead, I go home and I do the laundry, which I don't enjoy doing. And I fold some beet ravioli called cozzanze for friends coming over on Monday night, which I do enjoy doing. I worry about family issues with my sister on the phone 7 times a week. I schedule a date with my son for the latest Terrence Malick film. I answer 15 emails. I thank a friend for taking me out for my birthday early. I gave a few bucks to my friend Kenny because he's out of work and not eating. I go out with my friend Anthony to a late night establishment where we laugh and talk until 2 a.m. and then go home and cry a bit before I sleep because of the pain I share with some friends who are now going through a difficult divorce. And because I miss being able to see my mother very often. You know, human things, human being things, person things, Mark Bellatini things, not categorical things. Things a lot like Arnie Zane and Bill T. Jones kissing in public. No shame, no embarrassment, no explanation. A seamless part of their lives. Things that are very human. Things that are evidence of wholeness. Things not separated out from the rest of my story. My supper, my dancing, my grief, my laughter, my aches and pains. They're all equally part of my story. The best stories, after all, are whole, not partial, full, not empty, bold, not ashamed. The best stories remind us, as our children's story did this morning, that we are each part of the whole world. We're not just one little line in a thin, simple story. We're all part of everyone's stories. Every part of the world resonates inside every one of us. As the story put it this morning, all the world is here. It's there. It's everywhere. All the world is right where you are, right now. But we have to open our eyes to see it. The Pride Parade next Saturday is not going to change anyone's mind about anything. Fred Phelps and his family are still going to be cruel after it's over with. And legislatures will still pass laws making some of us in this room even more second-class citizens than we already are. And 90% of the folks walking in the parade not only don't know what happened at Stonewall, but were born long before it. And they certainly don't know any of the other history I spoke about this morning. So it's hardly some solid, sacred commemoration. The parade is really, and I'm glad that this is so, frankly, a great big block party. Some fun in the sun more than anything else. Jubilation. Togetherness. Allies walking together. But it is, in a way, about pride. It's about pride in being a human being. A human being that's a whole person. Not just pride in a certain kind of sexual or gender history, each of which remains and always will remain till the end of time entirely unique for each of us. None of us share a sexuality. None of us. It's all unique. But pride in everything about you and you and you and you and you and me as people, as human beings. Pride that the story of our story, when told fully, is filled with examples of open, courageous, and unashamed people over the last 5,000 years, and that not everything can be defined by the post-Stonewall coming out metaphor. Some people were never in the first place. I don't think any kissing I see in public during the parade will be as meaningful and as transformative as that first kiss that I saw between Arnie Zane and Bill T. Jones. But it ain't gonna hurt.